Repeal and replace is on hold again.
We don't have the votes.
Republicans move on to tax reform.
This is where it comes together. You get 435 people trying to figure out what's best.
And the gavel is about to drop on a new Supreme Court term.
It sort of pits this idea of religious liberty against LGBT rights.
It's time to get caught up on what's happened and what's next. I'm Jared Halpern from Washington. If real life was a Broadway musical, this scene in Hamilton may have provided a soundtrack for this week's setback for Republicans trying to repeal and replace Obamacare.
You need the votes.
No, we need bold strokes. We need this plan.
No, you need to convince more folks.
George Washington's advice to Alexander Hamilton, at least in that dramatized version of events, remains true today. If you don't have the votes, you don't have the votes. And Senators Lindsey Graham and Bill Cassidy, no matter how they tried to add it up, were short.
Well, to be clear, through events that are under our control and not under our control, we don't have the votes. Okay? That's in speaking to the leadership, speaking to the president. I think Lindsey and he are on speed dial. We've made the decision, since we don't have the votes, we will postpone that vote.
On Twitter and a few other times in scripted and impromptu remarks this week, President Trump said Republicans would have had enough votes to pass Graham Cassidy, but couldn't because of a senator in the hospital.
We have a wonderful senator, great, great senator, who is a yes vote, but he's home recovering from a pretty tough situation.
That senator is Mississippi Republican Thad Cochran. Now, his office put out a couple of statements about his health this week. Here's what they say. Senator Cochran was recently treated for a urological issue and is currently recuperating in Mississippi. A follow-up a few days later from the senator added he's improving and will return to the Senate on October 16th. All right, so Cochran would have missed a vote on Graham Cassidy and removed one yes vote from the tally. But it would not have mattered. Republicans are unified in their dislike of the Affordable Care Act, but the challenge has always been what a replacement looks like. As we've reported time and again, there is no support from Democrats, and at least three Republicans were no votes on this latest proposal. John McCain objects to the process, and Rand Paul and Susan Collins have concerns about substance. Add to that Ted Cruz, who early in the week said this at the Texas Tribune Festival in Austin.
Right now, they don't have my vote, and I don't think they have Mike Lee's either.
Alaska's Lisa Murkowski, who voted against the skinny repeal in July, was also uncommitted to Graham Cassidy. The bottom line is Republicans were potentially well short of the 50 votes needed to force a tiebreaker from the vice president with or without Senator Cochran. Of course, that does not mean the landscape won't change, and with a different process and tweaks to the proposal, Republicans could secure the votes in the Senate. Senator Graham believes that will happen.
With a new process, with more hearings, with regular order, that we're going to get 50 votes.
Graham and Cassidy met Thursday with President Trump about restarting the effort early next year. In a statement, the senators express a commitment to congressional hearings and working with governors and Democrats to find common ground. The Senate budget resolution, expected to be considered next week, also includes a path to repeal and replace major sections of the Affordable Care Act. So the health care debate is not over on Capitol Hill. Supporters of repeal and replace need to find the votes. Sidelining the latest Republican repeal and replace plan was just part of a bad week for Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. Our senior Capitol Hill producer, Chad Pergram, and I spent some time talking about how divisions within Republican and conservative circles are playing out on the Senate floor. Chad Pergram back with us on the podcast, and being as well-read as I am, I know, Chad, that you have read Alexander and the Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Bad Day. Let's talk about Mitch McConnell's day that was Tuesday and really the week. We had the day that started off with the health care defeat, the confirmation that they don't have the votes to pass Graham Cassidy. You had Bob Corker, a bit of a surprise, retiring, announcing he won't run for re-election. He's the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and a big ally of the majority leader. Then you had his preferred candidate, Luther Strange, lose the primary to Judge Moore in Alabama. We could talk about Louisville basketball and the setback that organization has had as well. We won't, but, you know, these other events really are showing a bit of division, a bit of challenge for Republican leadership?
Well, speaking of recruiting, that might be, you know, sort of the canary in the coal mine here. You had Roy Moore, who defeated the preferred candidate of President Trump and Mitch McConnell, the appointed senator, Luther Strange, who hadn't won anything, who was appointed to Jeff Sessions' seat, now the attorney general, and then Roy Moore defeats him. Now, what's going to happen, what some people predict, is could this be like 2010, 2012? Both were years that people thought that Republicans had a good shot of getting the Senate back. And they didn't, Jared, because there were people like Christine O'Donnell, I'm Not a Witch, if you remember the right. ad, running in Delaware, who got the nomination. You had Sharon Angle, who got the nomination over Danny Tarkanian, the son of the famous UNLV basketball coach. I'm sure, you know, some
it all
Joe,
comes back to college basketball.
Joe Rick Pitino in there somewhere. But Harry Reid wound up facing Sharon Angle rather than Danny Tarkanian, a very popular name in the state of Nevada. You know, she was just unelectable. She was too conservative. And so maybe what you might start to see here are Senate candidates on the Republican side who take out sitting senators or people who are too conservative and aren't electable. The only difference here is that Luther Strange was appointed. He wasn't elected, and so he didn't have as much of a cachet, and that might be the one asterisk we put in this.
Perhaps, but to your point, you have now, I think, in this win of the sort of anti-establishment faction of the Republican Party, you had, you know, Mitch McConnell sort of up against Steve Bannon is how it has been portrayed. You have other candidates now who are very energized. Kelly Ward is challenging Jeff Flake in a Republican primary. Danny Tarkanian against Dean Heller in a Republican primary. A lot of other names out there may get a lot more serious consideration because of what happened this week in Alabama.
Yeah, and we just have to see if it's the beginning of the trend. And that's bad news for Mitch McConnell because they spent, you know, several million dollars. You know, if you look at directly what was spent on the race, other groups that were spending in the contest here from the president's PACs and also from the PACs that Mitch McConnell is associated with. I mean, the fact that Roy Moore spent under $1 million in this race and won going away, that says a lot. And it probably translates to other places besides Alabama.
Roy Moore still has to win a general election in December. We'll see. Maybe Democrats are energized now in a way that they weren't previously.
Well, I think that Republicans might worry about this because that they would feel in a conservative state like Alabama, Luther Strange, who's more of a classic conservative Republican candidate kind of standard issue, you know, he would probably beat, you know, Doug Jones, the Democratic nominee, you know, hands down there. It wouldn't be as much of a contest. But keep in mind, we had an interesting thing here. You know, they say, you know, history doesn't repeat itself, but it sure does rhyme. Democrats might love the idea of running against Roy Moore because he's so ultra conservative. You don't know what turnout's going to be like in a runoff like this or a special election in December. It's close to the holidays. And here's where I talk about history, you know, perhaps not repeating itself, but rhyming. President Trump won Alabama about 68-32. We had a special election in January of 2010 in a state that President Obama carried, 68-31, almost exactly the same. That was Massachusetts. And they elected Scott Brown, a Republican. So who would have thought? So stranger things have happened, Jared.
You know, we talked about these candidates that may face, or these incumbents that may face some serious primary challenges. What role do you think this division that seems to be sort of on his doorstep, does that play in the decision of Bob Corker, an influential Republican, chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, has been critical of President Trump and also an ally, at least on foreign policy issues of President Trump, and a big ally, very close relationship with Mitch McConnell.
Yeah, Bob Corker had been, you know, critical of President Trump on the campaign, thought he needed more discipline. I thought that he wasn't being mature after some of his comments after Charlottesville and neo-Nazis and skinheads and white supremacists and everybody else. And he just thought that the president hadn't grown into his job, into the job. He had a one-on-one meeting with the president a couple of weeks ago. And, you know, Bob Corker is someone who was thought very well on both sides of the aisle. It was interesting to hear, you know, very, you know, congratulatory, fond statements coming out of the mouth of Chuck Schumer, the Democratic leader, about Bob Corker. And so, you know, this throws a race that for sure was going to be a Republican seat. That's unclear. You know, someone who's kind of a known quantity in Bob Corker. And now, you know, you might have someone who's like Bob Corker, but you might have somebody who's further to the right, or you might lose the seat. You know, it's anybody's ballgame, and that's part of the headache that Mitch McConnell is dealing with right now. These divides that are playing out right now in the Republican Party have been there for a long time. It's just that now, finally, they're starting to have these real-world political consequences and certainly policy consequences as to what we saw in health care, what we're probably going to see in some form, whether they pass it or not, on tax reform. And again, you know, these have been there for a while. I talk about what happened in 2010 and 2012, where they nominated unelectable Senate candidates, and it cost them the Senate.
We started talking about college basketball. Some college football, perhaps, is going to make its way to Capitol Hill. You're hearing the same rumors about Tennessee quarterback legend Peyton Manning. He's a close friend, very close with Senator Corker. The two golfed together recently with the president, right?
Yeah, and he has kind of said that it's something he hasn't thought about. He might prefer, you know, selling pizza and insurance. One person who is looking at this is Republican Tennessee Representative Marsha Blackburn, right, who said, you know, she's going to take a couple of weeks and figure this out. She's a known quantity. She is conservative. She's someone who has sided more with the president on this. But whether or not you get a celebrity candidate, we don't know. We have had other NFL stars in Congress, John Runyon, the former lineman, who served from New Jersey. So there have been some people here from the NFL.
Chad, by the way, mentioned the nitty-gritty of tax reform. We will get into that nitty-gritty a little bit later on the podcast with a Republican on the Tax Writing House Ways and Means Committee. Monday is the first Monday of October, and that means a new Supreme Court term. This term will begin how the last one ended, with a full complement of 9 justices following the confirmation of Justice Neil Gorsuch earlier this year. So what's on the docket and what could be added? It was exciting to talk about it with a fellow Fox News podcaster and soon-to-be primetime news anchor, Shannon Bream, host of the Living the Bream podcast and starting in October anchor of Fox News at Night.
It's great to be with you, Jared. It's nice to have somebody who really loves the court and likes to track it as much as I do. We have a lot of good times at the Supreme Court.
Good times is not how a lot of people would.
It's hard talk work, about, but we do have fun.
One of the first big cases we expected to hear, actually this month, was on the president's travel ban. That's now on hold, that unsigned order from the court coming out this week. Why are they not taking this up?
It's interesting because parts of the order were set to expire before they'd ever get to argument. So there had been a lot of kind of consternation about whether this case would be moot before it even got there, or what the administration planned to do about it. Well, Sunday night, as you know, we got new travel ban guidance. Some people calling this now travel ban 3.0, essentially changing the countries that were involved, some of the requirements that are involved. So the court essentially, once it was notified by the administration about these changes, put out that order you mentioned and said, listen, we want both parties, both sides of this, to brief us by the 5th of October and tell us whether this case is over or where we go from here. And then they took the case off the argument calendar. So a lot of folks think, you know, if the briefing is convincing and persuasive that there's an undecided issue they need to get involved with the case, we'll go back onto the calendar. But for now, it's gone.
The argument was scheduled for the 10th. As you said, these briefs are due at on the 5th. Does that mean that it could go back to the 10th, or is this something that if the court were going to take it up again, they would wait till later in the term?
I think it's possible. Truly, I think either way is possible because you know the court acts very quickly in matters of great import. There's another part of this travel ban dealing with refugees that will expire later in October. So that case, people, you know, will argue that part of the case is still a live controversy. So, I mean, that's an open slot there on the 10th. They have not added another case in its place. That would be really a quick maneuver for them to do. But because this case has been fully briefed, lawyers, as you know, have been preparing for weeks and months to argue the case. I would say it's still a possibility that if they get those briefs by noon on, I think it's going to be next Wednesday or Thursday. It's Thursday. That case could be back by the following week. I think it's possible.
So one of the cases they're going to hear right off the start Tuesday is this case out of Wisconsin redistricting. Some people calling it a big challenge to the act of gerrymandering. This is going to impact whatever opinion the justices reach is going to have an impact far beyond Wisconsin's borders.
Yeah, it really could. I mean, this is something where the Republican-led legislature, once they took power, I think it was in 2010 in Wisconsin, they then, you know, it's part of their job every so often to redistrict and to recraft these districts. And they did that, and they were very successful. So the next round of elections, the Republicans gained even more seats at the state level. And so Some people say if you look at this, it's the classic, looks almost comic book like the way that these little trails are you know, through one neighborhood, down one street, and up another. But that doesn't necessarily make them illegal. That's what the court's going to have to decide. In the past, it's really been about, is there a discriminatory impact here? And the fact that the way we have data and what's available to us and the way that it can be crunched street by street, house by house, that really changes the way that political operators go after things. And so with that amount of data, you really can craft something that will guarantee almost a win for your particular party. So is that unconstitutional? Where should the court step in? Is this something left to the states? You know, there's a similar conversation being had in Texas right now, a case that is on appeal to the court as well. So, yeah, I think it could stretch far beyond just Wisconsin.
So let's talk about what may end up on the docket. What is not on the docket yet? That Colorado Baker challenge is not something that the court has yet agreed to take up, but have given a lot of hints that they're interested in, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, they're going to hear it. We just don't know what the date's going to be.
Okay.
It hasn't gotten onto the calendar yet. And so this is one of many, many cases we've seen over the last few years, thinking eventually the court would take one where it's sort of pits this idea of religious liberty against LGBT rights. And essentially, it's a Colorado baker who said, I will sell a cake to anyone. I'm happy to do that. I won't design and craft a specific cake for a same-sex ceremony. And he got a lot of trouble in Colorado. I mean, essentially,
There's a law in place in Colorado that's being challenged, right?
Right. And so there's this very fine line between people saying, these, you know, religious business owners will say, I'm not denying service to anyone. I will serve anyone. You can come in here and buy any cake or cookie. You can come buy a floral arrangement. It's when you ask me to create something specific to your ceremony that makes me feel like I'm participating or in some way endorsing the ceremony. For me, my religious beliefs don't allow me to do that. So it's a really hot debate because people feel like it is legalized discrimination if you allow them to say no to that. And others feel like forcing them to do it is a real breach of religious liberty. So there have been a number of cases. They finally have one at the court that at least four justices say they want to hear. And I think that Justice Gorsuch's vote, honestly, right. We don't know. But
well, that's
my
what
guess
I was
is that made a big
because
difference.
I know that was such a big part when he was going through the confirmation process. You know, those on the side that believe that this is religious discrimination felt like they were going to have a big ally in Justice Gorsuch.
Right. And I think because he had been involved with some of the lower court decisions and rulings regarding Little Sisters of the Poor, and that group of nuns, religious order, who had been challenging whether they should be forced to comply with the Obamacare contraceptive mandate. He was somebody who weighed in on some of those cases as a lower court judge. And so a lot of people looked to him as somebody they thought would be a key vote on religious freedom. And I think that he is the reason that they're hearing this case.
I started this by saying that they're going to have a full complement of nine justices. There's no way there's going to be a retirement before they adjourn in the summer, in June.
You would not think so. But of course, what happened with Justice Scalia was such a shock to everybody.
Right.
I mean, there's
yeah,
so many
obviously
unpredictable.
That, yeah.
Yeah, unpredictable.
But a retirement
things.
Would be pretty shocking.
Yeah. And I think, you know, Justice Gorsuch and Justice Kennedy are the first pair of former boss and former clerk who are now on the court at the same time together. And I think there was a big interest for both of them in kind of having this year together, at least on the court. I mean, everything I've heard points to Justice Kennedy retiring next summer. But, you know, listen, that's months away. He seems to be in very good health. He seems very engaged mentally with the work as well. So we'll see. I mean, there's a lot of pressure on the Democrat appointees not to go anywhere, to eat their Wheaties, to keep up their vitamins and their workouts.
Shannon, I'm excited to watch another term from a few rows, usually a few rows behind your front row seat. There
we are in it together, my friend.
And happy to have you back in Washington very soon.
Thanks, Jared. See you soon.
All right.
It was tax reform week for Republicans. The White House and GOP congressional leaders are rallying around a tax code overhaul they promise will let middle-class Americans keep more of their take-home pay. Right now, those ideas are in a framework. It will be up to tax writing committees in the House and Senate to turn it into legislation. One of the lawmakers tasked with that is Pennsylvania Republican Mike Kelly. He sits on the House Ways and Means Committee and the Tax Policy Subcommittee. We chatted this week in his office.
We've heard so many times from President Trump that this is not going to benefit the wealthiest Americans.
Right,
he likes
right.
to joke it's not going to be good for him.
Yes.
The obvious question, though, is the top tax bracket comes down and the bottom tax bracket goes up. How does that mesh with the president's promise?
Well, here's how it meshes. First of all, the bottom tax bracket does not go up. it got eliminated. So we're now, if you look at it, we took the 15 to 12 and then the 10 to zero. So when people talk about, well, you're hurting those lower income people, say, wait a minute, we doubled standard deductions. We've done a lot with child tax credits. We're doing everything we can to help the most vulnerable. And somehow they said, well, yeah, but you raised their taxes to 12. I said, no, we raised 50, we took 15 down to 12. We took 10 to zero.
Well, so that's the question. So the promise is if you were in that 10% tax bracket, yes, now, you are not going to be moved up to 12%.
Well, you know what? Now, when we talk about the brackets, that's the next thing that people ask about. They talk about the rates, but then they talk about the brackets. And as you know, we're talking earlier, the framework is in place. Now we have to fill it all in. And the real challenge right now as we sit down is making sure that we're taking care of middle-income people and lower-income people because they have the heaviest burden on them when it comes to taxes, paying your taxes, raising your family, owning a home, being able to move forward with education and all those things that they work penny to penny on, as opposed to people who worry about big dollar amounts. They go penny to penny, and those are the people that I represent.
I do want to talk about what happens to tax rates and tax liabilities for the wealthy, but let's start with the middle class, because you talk about the standard deduction doubles.
Yes.
Will that make up for some of the deductions that are eliminated? And I'm thinking primarily the one that keeps getting talked about is there's right now a deduction for local and state taxes. Now, you're from Pennsylvania. Right. People get a tax credit for the taxes that they pay in Pennsylvania. They're not going to get that anymore.
Well, when you talk to people, and I think sometimes the confusion comes out, there's 50 states that are represented. Some of the states are in a different position than other states. And I have friends on both sides of the aisle, really, that represent those folks back home. When you look at some of the states that have very high state and local taxes, those representatives are looking, you know what? This is going to have an effect that we have to take a look at. And so what I always say to people is, look, we got the framework done. We're filling it in. Everybody, because we're going to be in regular order, is going to have a chance to be at the table, present that concern that they have, and we can take it into consideration. The devil's always in the details. We know that. Once we get it fleshed in, get everything put in there, do it the old way, do it the new way. Does it benefit you?
Would you support eliminating that tax deduction for state and local taxes?
Well, what I support is us having the ability to work together to find out what's best for the people we represent. You know, when you look at a 78,000-page code that we work on today and said we're going to try to simplify it, make it fair, make it about jobs and making it about people to keep more of their money and not sending it to the government, that debate is going to be open and it's going to be free-flowing. And I think for a lot of us, you look at people that come from other states, the concern that they have may not be a concern that I have, but it's important for me to hear what they have to say. Now we're going to have the debate. Now we're going to have the focus groups. Now we're going to have the time to say, okay, but if you push it down here, it pops up someplace else. And people are going to say, you know what? I didn't realize that's what takes place in your state. I was thinking about my state and my district. So this is where it comes together. You get 435 people trying to figure out what's best for the folks that they represent. That's a lot of decision making and a lot of opinion to be taken into accord.
Let's talk about the top tax bracket. That's reduced down to what's it,
35, yeah,
from about 39% right now. So how is that not a tax cut for the super wealthy?
Well, but it is. But if you look across the board, and I think Chairman Brady expressed it really well the other day, he said the elevator is going down at all levels. So the other point that's in there that hasn't been discussed with yet is the president said, you know what? Maybe we need something else done at the upper levels. All I can tell you is right now, the goal was to lower taxes for folks to make sure that everybody's taken care of proportionally.
There's been talk of a potential fourth tax bracket
I've
at the top. Would you support that?
I you know what I'll support? The discussion to have over that and to see how it's going to affect it. Because at the end, you know, we keep talking about it has to be revenue neutral. So when you have tax cuts, you got to find a way how you're going to pay for them. So I'm very open to the discussion on how we're going to pay for the tax cuts. There'll be many things brought forward. That certainly is going to be one of the things that's at the very top of the list.
One more question on the tax policy. You mentioned fair share. Is 20% fair for corporations?
Well, you know, I think that what we're looking to do in a global economy, I think you look at the game films and say, who's winning and who's losing? And when we find out that we're losing and that we're seeing businesses in our country go someplace else, they're not leaving because they're not patriotic. They're leaving because our taxes and our regulation make it impossible for them to compete globally. All we're trying to do in that case is to take a look at what makes us competitive globally. So I think you have to look at that. I was more concerned, though, with the pass-throughs. Those folks that are in that category, those S-corps, I don't want to affect them to the point where they can't stay in business, because they're the biggest drivers of job creation and wealth. And they're the people that do so much to help grow our economy and create jobs. So I want to make sure that when we look at these things, we don't get confused. But as you know, look, when we start talking about corporate taxes, we're talking about 10% of the revenue, and it gets about 100% of the attention. I'm more worried about that 90%, those hardworking American taxpayers that get up every day, they go to work, mom goes to work, dad goes to work, and they just want to make sure that they're taking care of their families and they're growing and they're doing the right things. Those are the people that really I'm concerned with. Lower income people, middle income people, the people that are the staple of our society, those are the ones I'm really concerned about helping.
I appreciate you letting me ask some wonky questions, Congressman.
No, that's okay. Thank you. I appreciate it.
About an hour before I sat down with Congressman Kelly, this happened on the House floor.
You have no idea how great this feels to be back here at work in the People's House.
House Republican Whip Steve Scalise brought his colleagues, Republicans and Democrats, to their feet in uproarious applause. He walked into the chamber wearing tennis shoes and aided by crutches, but he wore a broad smile, fist pumps and hugs to go around about 3 months after being shot at a congressional baseball practice in Virginia. It was an emotional and unifying end to the week and a message about faith and debate.
As we're fighting through the issues of the day, let's just keep in mind that we rise above the challenges of the day and understand that it's not just us and our constituents and the country, the United States, that's counting on us being successful. People all around the world that believe in freedom are counting on us as well, and we will deliver for them. That's why I am so honored to be back here in the House serving with you. God bless each and every one of you.
Welcome back, Congressman. And that will do it for the From Washington podcast this week. If you like what you're hearing, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. As always, the news breaks fast both in and out of Washington, so stay tuned to your Fox News Radio affiliate, as well as our social media pages on Twitter and Facebook for updates on the latest stories. For all of us at Fox News Radio, I'm Jared Halpern from Washington.